From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Congress has passed new legislation to prevent another deadly fungal meningitis outbreak. But is it enough?
That is the million-dollar question. Basically, the FDA is crossing their fingers and hoping that clinics and hospitals will say, oh, man, we are only going to buy from pharmacies that have this special FDA seal of approval.
And what will the growing number of Amish in Michigan mean for our economy?
There are more economic possibilities. In some ways, it's easier to be Amish economically today than it was 50 or 60 years ago.
And the band Dale Earnhardt Jr. Jr. stops by to describe their music.
I think of like hip-hop folk combining, where it's very danceable and has like a vibe to it, but there's also you can't escape the fact that we're two guys harmonizing with each other.
Those stories and much more. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The Amish community in North America has grown 20% over just the past 5 years. On today's show, we explore what's behind the growth and what it means for Michigan. And then the band Dale Earnhardt Jr. Jr. stops by the studios to talk about the inspiration for their music. But first, after last year's fungal meningitis outbreak, lawmakers said never again. Today, 22 Michiganders are dead and more than 700 people are sick nationwide. And it's all because a single Massachusetts pharmacy made contaminated drugs and sent them out to doctors all across the country. This week, a federal prosecutor says the criminal investigation into that pharmacy is moving ahead. And Congress recently passed a bill that's supposed to prevent another epidemic. But is this just a bunch of grandstanding? Does any of this actually give victims justice? Michigan Radio's Kate Wells has been investigating for the last year now, and she's here to give us the inside story. Welcome, Kate.
Hi, Cindy. Thanks for having me.
So, real quick, remind us again how this all began.
It started with bad back pain injections. And, Cindy, let me ask before we get going, do you know anybody who goes and gets these back pain injections?
I do, and I have to say he just can't wait. You know, that it just matters so much to get that injection to control his back.
Yeah, a lot of us know somebody who really relies on these things. Mm-hmm. And these back pain shots are this massively growing industry. You'll know what I mean when you think of any time you drive past a pain clinic or you open a paper and you see ads for pain management. These are places that are often going to do steroid injections. They're going to put them right near your spine, and that's supposed to really help back pain. There is a lot of debate in the medical community about whether these are actually effective, but plenty of people, like your friend, it sounds like, will tell you these are the only things that actually help. So that's what these were. The way that they went bad is that doctors are supposed to be getting these drugs from drug makers, right? I mean, we think of like the big guys, Pfizer.
Sure.
We assume that that's where our doctors go and get their drugs when we come into their clinics and they inject us with something.
Yeah.
Not the case in this time. They were actually getting these drugs from something called a compounding pharmacy. None of us had ever heard that term before fungal meningitis, but essentially they just do individual prescriptions. They're like your old-timey apothecary. You go in, you need a pill made into a cream, the doctor gives a prescription, and the pharmacist sends it back. They are, and I cannot stress this enough, they are not supposed to make meds in bulk, because they're just not overseen by the FDA. But this Massachusetts pharmacy, the one that caused all of the trouble, they were making huge shipments of these bulk medications. And as we now know, they were shipping them out all over the place. And their drugs became contaminated. How bad? When I talk with people who have actually gone in and seen the clinic, they talk about actually being able to see black particles in these vials that were then injected directly into people's backs. One of the women who died here in Michigan, her name was Karina Baxter. She was in her 50s. Her daughter, Anita, is now actually suing the New England Compounding Center.
I don't even care about the lawsuit. These people, they kill people. They're murderers. They need to go to prison, not lose their money.
So it's been more than a year now. Has anybody gone to prison, or are they going to prison?
We don't know yet. Nobody's gone to jail yet, though, and it's been incredibly frustrating for these victims and their families because so much of what's going on, this investigation and this probe into whether or not there was criminal misconduct, it's all behind closed doors.
Ooh.
There's a federal grand jury. There's criminal probes in Massachusetts and Michigan. They just teamed up. And while the pharmacy is bankrupt now, and it'll probably end up paying a lot of money in a lawsuit, when you actually divide it up, lawyers I talk to say it's going to be very little for individual families and victims themselves.
Well, meantime, Congress is making lots of noise about keeping this kind of epidemic from ever happening again. They passed a bill recently giving the FDA the power to crack down on bad pharmacies. But What matters, Kate, is whether this bill could actually prevent another fungal meningitis outbreak.
It depends on who you talk to. Let me be straight up with you, Cindy. There are plenty of critics. Even the FDA will tell you in their FDA language, well, it's not everything that we hoped for, which is the federal government way of saying it doesn't have a lot of teeth. But before we get too critical, we should admit that it is progress because it makes the rules clear. At least it says, okay, if you're a pharmacy and if you're outsourcing a lot of drugs, the FDA at least has power to oversee what you're doing. Here's the twist.
Okay.
Pharmacies have to volunteer themselves for this oversight.
Really?
So if I'm a pharmacy and you're the FDA, I have to say, Cindy, I would really like you to come in and give me some extra regulations because I'm making a lot of these drugs. So you should check me out. And oh, by the way, I have to pay you a fine for the privilege of that oversight. It's probably going to be about $15,000.
So why in the world would any compounding pharmacy say, okay, sign me up for this extra expensive regulation?
Right. That is the million-dollar question. Basically, the FDA is crossing their fingers and hoping that clinics and hospitals will say, oh man, we are only going to buy from pharmacies that have this special FDA seal of approval, this good housekeeping seal of approval. And they say, and they being lawmakers and the FDA, they say that the extra fine is important and it's worth it because the FDA is already overworked, they're understaffed, and there's something like 7,500 compounding centers out there. So maybe that'll work. Maybe if the public is aware that this FDA seal of approval is out there, when you next go in to get your back pain injections, you're going to say, hi, doctor, is this thing been approved by the FDA? And the doctors may want to tell you, yes, it has been. That's an assumption, though. And we also have to be careful and remember that if I, say, run a sketchy pharmacy and I want to keep my prices cutthroat so that doctors and clinics want to come buy from me, I may not change what I'm doing at all. So the ultimate question is this law going to actually stop another epidemic like the fungal meningitis outbreak? Hopefully it will. It may mean more big outsourcing pharmacies get better oversight, but if doctors and clinics decide they don't really care about the FDA seal of approval on these back pain medications, then no, it will not stop this from happening again.
Michigan Radio's Kate Wells has been reporting on the fungal meningitis outbreak for almost a year now. Kate, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me, Cindy.
The type of turkey you buy for your big holiday feast isn't always an easy decision. You can choose the usual supermarket bird, or you could get a kosher turkey, or one that's been fed only organic feed. You can also buy a heritage turkey that has a little wilder history. The Environment Report's Rebecca Williams has the story of farmers trying to keep these older turkey breeds from going extinct.
John Harnoy has a yard full of turkeys. He says he knows them so well, he can actually speak their language.
The turkeys pip, they bark, they gobble.
These turkeys are mostly males. They're trying to look all big and macho as they strut around in front of the hens. These birds are the Narragansett breed.
They're old-time turkeys. They're much closer to wild. They don't have the broad breast, so proportionally for eating, they have more dark meat to white meat.
People who've tasted a heritage turkey say the flavor is stronger, too. Sarah Dickerman did some turkey taste testing for Slate.com. She tried everything from the Butterball brand to kosher to heritage.
When you taste one of these heritage breeds, you're getting more of a, you know, it begins to taste more like a distinct meat. And I'm afraid that our vocabulary is so ill-suited to describing it, except that it tastes meatier, it tastes more intensely, and just has a resonance that you'll never get in a Butterball.
She says, still, you've got to be pretty committed to buy a heritage turkey. They can cost upwards of $100. Taste and cost aren't the only things that set the heritage turkeys apart from the turkeys you find in the grocery store. Your common grocery store turkey is a breed called the broad-breasted white. These turkeys have been bred over the years to produce a lot of meat in a short period of time. As a result, they're large-breasted birds with short little legs. John Harnoy says that means they can't mate naturally.
One of the things about the heritage birds is that they can mate. They're small enough to mate as opposed to the broad-breasted, which is artificial insemination. They're just, with that big breast, they just can't do the deed.
But even though heritage turkeys can mate naturally, they haven't been doing so well on their own.
These birds, the heritage breeds, were real close to dying out. And it's funny, you got to eat them to keep them going. To keep their genetics in the gene pool, there has to be a market for them.
John Harnoy says he is earning money from his heritage turkeys, but it's not easy money. Heritage turkeys cost a lot to raise, and it takes longer to get them to market weight. And unlike the commercial turkeys, the heritage birds can actually fly the coop.
And you're chasing them, and it's dark out, and oh, you don't know if you're going through poison ivy. So if you got shorts on, you got to go and change your pants to long pants. It's a pain.
But he says the late night chases and the extra turkey TLC, it's all worth it.
You don't want everything being the same. And if you only have one thing and something happens to it, there's no more. Where are the turkeys going to come from?
He says he just feels like it's his job to make sure there will always be plenty of different kinds of turkeys to go around. Happy Thanksgiving. I'm Rebecca Williams.
Still to come, the guys behind the band, Dale Earnhardt Jr. Jr., stop by the studios. They'll talk about their music and tell us what's behind that name.
We were going to call ourselves Counting Crows Part 2. And then I was telling my friend Andy about that, and he was like, you guys are idiots. I mean, you might as well call it Dale Earnhardt Jr. Jr. And I was like, yes.
That's coming up next. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. We turn now to a Michigan-based musical group that's been getting a lot of national acclaim and sports one of the more memorable names, Dale Earnhardt Jr. Jr. Dale Earnhardt Jr. Jr. is Joshua Epstein and Daniel Zott, both from Metro Detroit. And we have Joshua and Daniel in the studio with us now. Good to have you with us.
Oh, it's good to be here.
So I'm curious how you cross paths. Who found whom?
Well, we kind of knew each other.
Oh, you knew of each other from the Detroit music scene?
Mm-hmm. I had a roommate that was bless his heart, he's the best human being alive. And he was working on a documentary about Daniel's band. And so Daniel came over to pick up a copy of, an advanced copy, and my roommate wasn't there. And so I had a guitar there, and Daniel played me one of his songs, and I remember thinking, oh, man, this guy's better than me, and I was so mad about it. and then I realized that maybe it would be worth trying to make something with him. So I think I called him, and then...
So you did the reach out. Joshua reached out to Dan. And were you – sometimes people aren't interested in collaborations because they're kind of pretty happy in their own thing.
Yeah, I think it's always hard to work with someone new, especially creating art is a weird thing to do with someone that you've never done it before. You don't know their personality. You don't know how – but my initial reaction was but I obviously didn't say that on the phone, you know. But I really was skeptical, but when he came over and the first day we wrote Simple Girl, which is on It's a Corporate World, and everything just was so easy. And you think, I thought, maybe there'd be a clash of egos because we're both front men. We both have been doing this for forever. We both think we're really great at what we do. And it was the opposite of that. It was a very, it felt like home. She won't ever let you meet her family, but she'll show you pictures. Da 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 da. She's a simple girl, she's got simple emotions. She won't ever let you in, but she wants to keep you in her corner.
So everybody's question has got to be, and you probably get asked this a million times, where'd the name come from? Who came up with Dale Earnhardt Jr. Jr.?
Well, we didn't actually think that this was going to be a band. It was more of an experiment, a recording
like a project.
Yeah. So
okay.
So we when we first started thinking about it, we were going to call ourselves Counting Crows Part 2. And then I was telling my friend Andy about that, and he was like, you guys are idiots. You should just call it, I mean, you might as well call it Dale Earnhardt Jr. Jr. And I was like, yes. And then I texted him. It's just stuck. But we didn't think anyone was ever going to hear it.
And lo and behold, they have. Have you actually, I'm curious, Daniel, have you heard from Dale Earnhardt Jr.?
We have. Actually, we were very nervous. After we signed with Warner Brothers, we were kind of nervous that they were going to make us change the name because it was such a fun thing. And but we understood they were about to print 10,000 copies of a record, and if he comes after us, then they got to throw them all out. So we really thought about it, and we're like, okay, maybe we should change the name. But in a last second, I think 5 days, maybe 4 days before we had to like make this decision, Josh wrote to Dale Earnhardt Jr., and we actually got a response back, I think the day of,
really?
Like, that we were supposed to make this decision, and he totally, you know, not only just said, you know, we're not going to come after you, but like talked about how he likes our music and how he showed it to some of his friends, and Jimmy Johnson's teased him about all these fun things. And was super kind and wished us the best luck on the road and be safe and
go off with his
blessing.
It just
blew our minds. Yeah, so, I think our manager cried actually.
That's pretty cool. And everybody's relieved because you didn't have to go through the what are we going to call ourselves now? Well, it really seems that as I was reading about you and reading articles about you, critics and writers are all over the map as they try to describe your sound. I've seen minimalist, alterna pop, retro pop, beach wave. So I'm wondering, how do each of you describe the music you make?
I feel like we really like try and write for the song, you know? I think that this project is a little bit different because we've both been doing this since we were like 12 years old and like serious about it. So for each of us, it's like our 10th record, our first record as a group was like our 10th record. So it's like I think that like in a way we're kind of lucky that it happened a little bit later, like in our like late 20s or mid to late 20s, because we like really know how to do what we're trying to do at this point, which, you know, I think sometimes you get like bands get lucky and they like stumble on something and then, you know, they're trying to like recreate it. And, you know, I think for us, it's like we make songs. I think we're both, you know, pretty good at coming up with ideas, and then we kind of go in whatever direction the song dictates that we should go.
With no label, is what you're saying.
Yeah, we try and just be open.
I think one of the things that we discovered with, hey, we can do anything now because this is a new project, we talked about what we kind of loved, and I always loved making hip-hop beats, and I think one thing we couldn't avoid was the fact that we're two guys kind of singing folky in a way. So I think that's kind of made... when I hear it, I think of like hip hop folk sort of combining, where it's very danceable and has like a vibe to it. But there's also, you can't escape the fact that we're two guys harmonizing with each other all the time.
And speaking of that, let's take a listen right now to a track off the upcoming album, The Speed of Things. This one is called I Can't Help It. If you've just joined us, we are talking with Joshua Epstein and Daniel Zott, who are known as Dale Earnhardt Jr. Jr. Their second album, The Speed of Things, is going to drop October 8th from Warner Brothers Records. What genres and artists actually did influence you as you were growing up? Like, what were Mom and Dad listening to?
A lot of Beatles. Beatles and Motown.
Yeah, Motown, Steve Winwood.
I had this, around the same time I got my guitar in junior high, I think a documentary on PBS came out about the Beatles. It was the whole anthology thing. Mm-hmm. And that just blew my mind. All of a sudden, I knew all four of their names, all what they play, like really dug deep, learned every single one of their songs on guitar. So that had a huge influence on me. But before that, it was a lot of, I loved Stevie Wonder. I loved the Jackson 5, anything really Motown.
My mom was always real current. Like she had, I remember driving me to school, and she was listening to like, she had like the Megadeth record. And she had like a Pantera record in her car.
Mom liked to rock.
Mom liked the rock. My dad listens to old blues, like fingerstyle blues, like Reverend Gary Davis and Taj Mahal and stuff like that.
So you really both grew up with a real interesting stew of musical influences. What does being from Detroit mean for you guys as you move onto the national stage? And what by that I mean, has the success of artists like Kid Rock and Eminem, does that give newer artists like you a boost, or is it a burden with preconceived notions that people outside of Michigan have about, oh, you're from Detroit, oh, Eminem, Kid Rock?
I think it depends. Like, for some reason, every time we're in the UK, it's like a huge amount of credibility that we somehow have because we're from here. But then, I think other times people kind of like expect that we're going to sound kind of garagey or something. But I think that like being from Detroit to me is really about like working hard all the time and, you know, not necessarily it's not a flashy place, but but the quality of the musicians, the quality of the music that comes from it is up there with anything that I've ever, any town I've ever been to in the world.
Yeah, I hope we can expand what people think about when they think of Detroit, because I don't want it to be garage rock or Eminem for forever. It can't be, right? Like that's, we have to have newer things. So if we can be a part of people saying, oh, yeah, well, they have also like weird hip hop, folk, whatever they want to call it, or just good pop music, I think would be an amazing feat.
You've been quoted when talking about the upcoming album, The Speed of Things, and here was the quote that kind of struck me. We're a generation full of false starts. What's that mean? What do you mean by that?
Well, I think we're it's a real weird point in time in like the history of humanity, because we, like Daniel and I were both born, before the internet happened, but we're young enough that when the internet happened, we were fluent in it. So we're like straddling this line of you know, where technology just kind of like had a boom. And I think that because of the easy access to information and the speed at which information comes, right now it's a strange time for anyone who has an idea, because you don't necessarily know where to start. Everything's gotten so big. Like it used to be that you could that there was a record store on your corner, and that there was like, you know, little shops, little things, but you know, everything's getting so top heavy and there's like one corporation at the top who's now owns everything. And so pretty soon there's going to be five corporations in the world that own everything. And I think it that kind of makes it so that you don't necessarily know where to go or what to do or how to do anything, you know?
Like just a sense of standing on a cloud, not on terra firma.
Yeah. Like how do you figure out where to begin when...
And it's changing so fast that like the ground beneath you is never the same. The sky above you is never the same. That sort of thought.
The album is on Warner. Now you've signed with the big label. How was that? And was there a sense of concern that having a big label watching over the process would impact what you do?
I think there's always concern, especially for artists, because they seem to be very, for whatever reason, not willing and not open to other people's ideas, which I think is a shame. But we tried to stay open, and we also, you know, read the contract. So it was a decent contract, and we fought for things that we thought we deserved, and we got a lot of them. And so that was a good starting point where they negotiated things that we wanted. And so I think starting off on that foot where they trusted us, we trusted them, I think it's been we've been pretty happy with the relationship and how it works with making music.
But I think that they're also a real good, like, it sounds like I'm like being all name droppy, but I was talking with Wayne Coyne about Warner Brothers, and he made the point that like as opposed to other major labels, everyone at Warner Brothers really cares about music, And that's not to say that they're going to keep their jobs or that you're going to stay at the label, you know, but I think that at least for us, we get the sense that everyone that works with us like really cares about the music. And they were actually the most open to letting us produce our own records of any label, even the independent labels we talked to. Warner Brothers was the one that was like, oh, yeah, go record in your basement and turn it in, and that's fine. So yeah. I think our experience has kind of been very opposite of what I imagined it would be.
And what and I've got to imagine what it would mean for you as artist for bigger exposure is you can't even put a handle on that, can you?
That was part of the draw, too, is we felt like we – I mean, I've always wanted as many people as possible to hear my art because I feel like it has value. And I think if you believe that, then signing with someone that has the best possibility of achieving that is smart, you know.
Tell us who's doing what. As we're listening, who's playing what? You mentioned, Daniel, you do keyboards as well?
Yeah. We all kind of switch instruments. Are you saying in the recording or live? Sorry.
Yeah, as we're listening in the recording.
Yeah. I mean, we kind of do a little bit. If it just whoever's sort of feeling it in the moment. We both play bass on the record. We both play keyboards. We both play guitar. We obviously both sing. So it's very much a mixture.
And a shout out to your percussionist.
Yeah,
Mike Higgins. A little bit
he played some
one,
drums
yeah.
on the record.
But we play drums too. Actually.
Yeah, we play drums too. So it's always you know.
Yeah, I think that this
kind of control freaks.
Yeah, the idea behind this project was to not be stuck in a band situation where everyone has like a defined role because I think that. Like, the beauty of it, of our situation, is I can play Daniel a song on guitar, and, you know, he'll just pick up a keyboard, as opposed to having to feel like, oh, he's the guitar player. Mm-hmm. He's got to come up with it, you know? So I think that it's all about serving the song, and we're lucky that we, you know, we're both, like, jack-of-all-trades, master of none, I guess.
Yeah.
And your what I guess as you look ahead, where will you be or where do you want to be, let's say, 5 years from now?
Hmm. That's the question I get from my father-in-law.
Fathers-in-law are interested in like.
It would be amazing if we were, you know, here again promoting a new record that we were really excited about. As long as I'm making something that I'm excited about, I feel pretty happy.
Yeah, likewise.
Dale Earnhardt Jr. is Joshua Epstein and Daniel Zott. Thanks so much for coming in to talk with us today.
Thanks for having us.
And here at Stateside, we always like to hear from you. What are your thoughts about what's happening in the news? What stories do you think we need to tell? And what people should we profile? Let us know. You can find us very easily on Facebook. Just search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty, and that's spelled C-A-N-T-Y. We're on Twitter at Stateside Radio. And of course, always on the website, look for the Stateside link at michiganradio.org. Be sure to tune in tomorrow at this time for a special program, StoryCorps, Ties That Bind. We'll hear the best of the past 10 years of StoryCorps. My guess is it's a wise idea to have a box of Kleenex handy. There might not be a decent plan. It's not where you're from, but where you stand. Still to come, why some Amish families are deciding to move from family farms to small businesses and what that means for Michigan's economy. That's next here on Stateside from Michigan Radio. Yeah.
Stateside, I'm Cynthia Canty. When you think of the Amish, what comes to your mind? Horses, buggies, long dresses and bonnets, long beards, no electricity? Well, yes, there is all of that, but there is so much more to the Amish in America and here in Michigan, where the Amish population numbers in the neighborhood of about 11,000. We wanted to learn more about the Amish, especially find out what the rest of us might learn from them. Consider this. How does a one-room Amish schoolhouse going only to eighth grade with only a battery-powered clock in the way of technology, how do schools like that turn out highly successful entrepreneurs whose firms sometimes gross annual sales in the million-dollar range? Well, let's talk about the Amish. I'm joined now by Gertrude Enders Huntington. She's a retired lecturer from the University of Michigan and the co-author of Amish Children, Education in the Family, School, and Community. And she joins us from Kennett Square, Pennsylvania. Welcome to the program, Trudy.
Thank you.
And we're joined by Steve Nold. He's a professor of history at Goshen College in Indiana and co-author of The Amish. It was the companion book to the American Experience documentary on PBS. Steve, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
Trudy, I want to start with you because when you were a grad student at Yale in the 1950s, you decided you wanted to do your dissertation on an Ohio Amish community. Why were you drawn to them?
Because everybody else was studying how we're studying sort of our plundered planet, everything that people were doing wrong with the environment. And here were the Amish who were moving in often to farms that had been really worn down and building up the soil and having a positive effect on their environment. So I wanted to study how they did it and, more importantly, why they did that when their neighbors were acting differently.
And what was the reaction of your professors when you said, all right, I'm going to study the Amish?
Well, they were in favor because they knew they were going to die out, and they thought it'd be nice if I would document them before they died out. There were, at the time, about 30,000 Amish, and now they're about 280,000, so they didn't die out very well.
So clearly those professors were wrong. Steve Nolte, why has the Amish community grown as we've moved into the 21st century, when we see doubling in number every 18 to 20 years? What's behind that?
Well, a couple things. One, obviously, is that the Amish have large families. Most families have six or seven children on average. Some families even have many more than that. But it's not just the large number of children. It's an increasing, we would say, retention rate. That is, an increasing percentage of the children of Amish parents choose to join the Amish church and follow the Amish way of life as adults. In the mid-20th century, perhaps 60% of Amish children chose to follow the Amish way of life as adults themselves. And today, it's about 85 or 90% of Amish children who do. And some of the reasons behind that, I think, include the rise of Amish schools, which is mostly a phenomenon of the second half of the 20th century. The first Amish school in Michigan started in 1956, and today almost all Amish children across the country attend Amish schools rather than public schools. So there's that kind of early formation and influence of Amish schools. And I think another one of the reasons actually has to do, and this surprises some people, but I think it has to do with change in the Amish community, particularly economic change. In the mid-20th century, it was really necessary to be a farmer, a successful farmer, to be a real member of the Amish community. And in the later 20th century, changing Amish economic patterns, there are now Amish folks who have their own small businesses, maybe work for other Amish businesses or work in non-Amish businesses. In other words, there are more economic possibilities. In some ways, it's easier to be Amish economically today than it was 50 or 60 years ago.
Trudy, tell us just who are the Amish. I get the sense it's a real mistake to think of them as one great big unified group. Is there a formal definition of Amish?
There's an informal sociological definition, and usually when we're talking about the Amish, we refer to those who still drive a horse and buggy rather than own and drive an automobile. But there are many different kinds of Amish, different varieties of Amish, and they are also related to the Mennonites, who have a whole range of strictness also.
One of the things that makes it challenging to generalize about the Amish is that as a church, and maybe we should clarify that, to be Amish is to be a member of the Amish church. There certainly are ethnic group components to the Amish experience, but it does at the end of the day come down to being a member of the Amish church. But the Amish church is very locally organized. There are no synods or dioceses or conferences. It doesn't parallel a lot of other denominations that many listeners may be familiar with in the Christian tradition. The 280,000 Amish people in the U.S. and Ontario comprise a little over 2,000 local Amish church groups, and each of those local churches has the authority, I guess we would say, to establish its own rules regarding technology and dress and a whole range of other issues. So it's not much of an exaggeration to say that there are actually 2,000 slightly different ways to be Amish today.
That was Steve Nold, who's a professor of history at Goshen College in Indiana, and he's co-author of the book, The Amish. We're also speaking with Gertrude Enders Huntington. Trudy is a retired lecturer from the University of Michigan and co-wrote the book, Amish Children, Education in the Family, School, and Community, as we look in the Amish in America and here in Michigan. And let's get into just how much the Amish reject modern technology. And Steve, you had a terrific quote in your book: had they simply rejected all things modern, they would surely have become a fossilized subculture. And we've certainly seen from what you've said that hasn't happened. How do they manage to reject modern technology all the while living in the 21st century and in many cases operating big successful businesses?
Well, most Amish communities use three different strategies all at the same time: acceptance, rejection, and modification when it comes to different sorts of technologies. And the more conservative settlements might use rejection more often than acceptance, and some of those on the more progressive end of the Amish scale might use acceptance more often than rejection, but all of them are using adaptation to some degree. Ways in which Amish families or Amish churches have chosen, for example, to draw a distinction between use and ownership, and might say, for example, well, it's fine to make use of a car. We're not going to own a car. If we own a car, then that gives us that gives us the ultimate control. We have, as an automobile, the name suggests, automatic mobility. We can choose when we want to go, where we want to go. So we won't own a car, but we may use a car. We may hire someone to drive us someplace. Some Amish communities have said, look, we're not going to have telephones in our homes, but an Amish business might be permitted to have a business phone that's not in the home but is part of the business. Some Amish contractors and roofers have cell phones that they use because when they're out on the job site, they need to be talking with subcontractors. Then there are some other very conservative Amish communities that they wouldn't be making those adaptations. They wouldn't have a telephone connection of any sort, for example, and they would be very slow to hire a driver to take them someplace. But in all of these communities, the question of what are we going to accept, what are we going to reject, and what are we going to adapt is an ongoing and lively conversation. There really aren't things that are completely off limits for discussion. These things are things that are continually being discussed and weighed.
Trudy, do we see, or as you study these Amish communities, if a family's uncomfortable with maybe the more progressive approach their community takes, do you see people picking up stakes and moving to one that perhaps is more conservative? Do you see that much?
Yes, that certainly does happen. They move both ways. Some move to more conservative ones, and some families move to more liberal Amish communities, depending on what they're interested in, what they believe in, and what they're willing to accept or put up with. I mean, there's been whole communities in Michigan, in southern Michigan, that moved away because they didn't want to be influenced by some of the more wild groups in northern Indiana, and they didn't want their young people. They wanted their young people to be more isolated.
Okay, those wild groups in Indiana. What about that? You know, and that leads me to want to talk about the education of children in the Amish community. And I want to double back to that question that I posed at the beginning of our conversation: how do you get such successful entrepreneurs out of schools that go only to the eighth grade, and they don't have any of that technology that the rest of us considers imperative to a good education. Trudy, what did you find as you researched your book?
Well, I found that the Amish are extremely adaptable. People think they're ossified peasants, but they're not. They're very adaptable. And a lot of them are very good with machines, and they're fascinated by things like cell phones and computers, and they do go to libraries. So they often do learn how to manage even things like the computers, which they can't have in their home, but they're not forbidden to use in a place, most of them in a place like the library. Again, it's hard to generalize because there's such a range as to what they allow and what they don't allow. So it depends on which ones you talk to. But children in the Amish schools learn hard work. They learn to be diligent. And they also, I think, get a kind of confidence that they can try anything, even though they supposedly end their education in eighth grade. The attitude is that you keep on learning. Hmm. That gives you the basis from which you can go and learn the specialty that you need or want.
Yeah, I think that's really one of the key features is that schooling may end with eighth grade, but education certainly doesn't end with eighth grade. And the what we might talk about in formal terms as an apprenticeship, although the Amish don't really set them up as formal apprenticeships, but the idea that when one finishes eighth grade, you go to work in family business, family farm, a neighbor's business, and Amish teens at age 17, 18 have a lot of responsibility, in some cases responsibilities for ordering supplies, negotiating contracts, making sure there's delivery of finished goods, sorts of things that many people, you know, in wider society don't have those opportunities until they are in middle management type settings when they're in their 30s or 40s.
Talk to us about what happens to the Amish boy or girl who wants to think of more formal education, even college. Is that at all accepted in the community, or does that pose problems?
It poses problems. On occasion, it's been permitted, but it has not really worked out. However, they do take correspondence courses, and they take, and in many communities, or in some communities, they take the GED, so that they can work in factories.
I think one of the ways maybe to think about this is, do children in Amish homes ever go to high school or college? Occasionally they do. I think it's safe to say that if you are a 15-year-old and want to go to high school, if you're already thinking that differently than your parents at that age, there's really a very slim chance that you are interested in an Amish way of life as an adult. So the handful of Amish teens who go to high school or go to college are I think sort of destined not to be adult members of the Amish community. I mean, it's a bit like saying, you know, I want to live in North Dakota and I want to be a marine biologist. And at a certain point, you know, you're going to have to make a choice between one or the other of those things.
And one thing we should make clear, am I correct that children make a decision once they're adults whether they want to remain in the community?
That's right. The Amish Church practices baptism of adults. So you become a member of the Amish Church through baptism, but it's not the baptism of infants or even young children. Baptism is something that generally happens at the individual's discretion between the ages of usually 18 and 20, sometimes a bit earlier or a bit later, but generally the late teens. And so that's the point at which one would actually become a member of the Amish Church.
And do some of these young people take some time out, what the English might call a gap year, try life outside of the constraints of the Amish community?
Well, there are two authorities in Amish society, the family and the church. And in traditional rural society, often when one reached the age of 16, one came out somewhat from under the authority of the parents, had more free time, discretionary time, were able maybe retain some of their wages if they were working away from home. So you do have this liminal space in the late teen years where children are no longer completely under the authority of their parents, and they have not yet, in most cases, join the church and come under the authority of the church. So there is this period of time in which those in their late teens are living a bit between family and church, and so they're able to do some things that when they were younger, their parents wouldn't let them do, and when they get older and join the church, they're not going to be able to do. And that range of activity also again varies quite a bit from community to community. Some of the things that Amish young people in that stage of life are doing might seem to the rest of us to be quite tame, like going to the mall or going to the movie theater. In other cases, it may include some fairly deviant behavior, underage drinking, buying a car, reckless driving. So there really are a range of things. It's not the case, though, that every Amish person between the ages of 16 and 18 just goes wild by any means, although there have been some television documentaries that unfortunately give that impression. But it is the case across the board that there is this period of time in the teens when children in Amish homes are somewhat betwixt and between the two major authorities in their lives.
Finally, I'd like your thoughts, Trudy, as you began your study in your grad work in the 1950s, you were talking to me about how the public was very much against, and they were very resistant to the Amish for a myriad of reasons. But today, the public is very entranced by all things Amish, even as branding. That's something that it's got a lure. What is it about the Amish, do you think, that has us so entranced and interested in them today?
I think there are many things. I think one thing is their family life, the fact that they do hold on to their children. But I think also we imagine them as our grandparents or as living an ideal life. And there's such an emphasis on individualism in our contemporary culture that I think we are nostalgic about the importance of community and social responsibility, which, of course, the Amish feel very strongly, and they're very supportive of one another. And I think that's something else that appeals to us.
That was Gertrude Enders Huntington, retired lecturer from the University of Michigan and the co-author of Amish Children, Education in the Family, School, and Community. She spoke to us from her home in Kennett Square, Pennsylvania. And we've also been speaking with Steve Nold, who's a professor of history at Goshen College in Indiana. He also co-wrote The Amish, which was the companion book to the American Experience documentary on PBS. You've both given us new insights, and thank you so much for your time and for sharing with us.
You're very welcome.
Thank you.
Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Stateside is engineered by Bob Scahn. Contributors are Allie Billings, Emily Fox, and Mercedes Mejia. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.